Imagine you work in like an incredibly high-stakes environment, a job where on any given Tuesday, you might walk into a completely volatile, unpredictable situation.
Right, where you have to be ready for anything.
Exactly. And in those moments, your physical safety, maybe even your life, depends entirely on the colleagues standing to your left and your right. You have to trust them implicitly without a second thought.
Oh, absolutely. That trust is non-negotiable.
But now imagine discovering that those exact same colleagues are circulating images of, well, racial terror and deeply dehumanizing slurs in a digital group chat. And here's the kicker, your boss is in that chat too.
Wow.
Yeah. And your boss says absolutely nothing. What do you do with that realization?
I mean, it shatters the basic operational foundation of that workplace. The trust required to do the job simply, well, it ceases to exist.
It really does. So welcome to this deep dive into the source material. Today, we're exploring a striking new analysis that tackles exactly this nightmare scenario.
And it is a deeply unsettling scenario.
It is. We're looking at a piece by Eric Sanders, and it's titled The Rot Within: Institutional Bias and Command Failure. The text examines some explosive new allegations within the NYPD's Patrol Bureau Manhattan North Narcotics Unit. And it uses those allegations to trace a multi-decade pattern of structural breakdown.
Yeah, the author provides a highly detailed architectural view of the institution. It really forces you to look at the raw mechanics of how a police department functions, or, fundamentally fails to function when bias is allowed to take root and just grow unchecked.
Right. And look, before we get into the specifics, it's important to acknowledge that the author is diving into intensely charged territory here. We're talking about policing, race, structural bias, justice.
Very heavy topic.
Exactly. So our goal today isn't to litigate the politics of this or, tell you what to think about these broader societal issues. We are strictly mapping out the structural and historical arguments the author is making. He's arguing this is an architectural issue within the command, not just a behavioral one.
Precisely. The focus is entirely on the how and the why of the systems he describes. We are looking at the progression of a very specific type of institutional failure.
So let's start with the current crisis the author outlines, because the specific allegations rocking Patrol Bureau Manhattan North Narcotics are just, they're staggering.
They really are.
According to confidential sources cited in the analysis, a white detective allegedly took photos wearing a Ku Klux Klan uniform. And he didn't do this like in his living room. He allegedly did this inside a police facility.
And that location is a massive detail. I mean, he is alleged to have physically walked around a department building wearing that uniform.
Right, which implies.
It demonstrates a profound level of comfort within that specific environment. You don't
And.
do that if you think you're going to get fired on the spot.
Yeah, exactly. And that image was then allegedly circulated alongside an AI-generated image depicting a white officer dragging black monkeys near NYPD headquarters.
Which is just horrific.
It is. And the sources also report additional racist statements being shared in this same digital space, including phrases like hang Mexicans and gas Jews.
So we're looking at explicit, historically loaded symbols of extermination. This material moves far beyond, casual insensitivity. It's firmly in the realm of overt racial terror imagery.
Right. But I'm struggling with the leap from a digital chat to an institutional collapse, though. If I'm playing devil's advocate here, a group chat, even a horrific one, is ultimately just guys venting on their phones. It's vile, obviously, but how does that practically break a police department? Why does the author elevate this from a story about a few terrible individuals to a systemic threat?
Well, what's fascinating here is the defining element that bridges that gap. It's the audience in the chat. This material was reportedly shared in a group of about 18 officers, which, crucially, included supervisors.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, supervisory exposure changes the entire legal and institutional nature of the misconduct. It shifts the incident from individual deviance to command climate.
Because the bosses are watching.
Exactly. When something like this is transmitted through a network that includes the chain of command, the defense of invisibility is gone. The institution can no longer claim it didn't know.
Okay, let's unpack this. If I can try an analogy here to see if I'm tracking. If you find a termite in your backyard, it's an isolated bug problem, right?
Right.
But if you find 18 termites having a meeting inside your load-bearing walls and the exterminator is just standing there watching them do it, the house is structurally compromised.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
Yeah.
And the specific termites we're talking about here aren't just making offensive jokes in a vacuum. They are vested with state authority.
That's a huge point.
In a paramilitary hierarchy like a police department, Silence from an exterminator, or a supervisor in this case, isn't neutral. Silence equals institutional permission.
It's basically an endorsement.
Yes. It communicates to everyone in that chat that this behavior is survivable and accepted.
Right.
And we also have to remember the specific environment here. This is a narcotics unit. These officers carry weapons, they conduct surveillance, they have the power to deprive citizens of their liberty. When you introduce Klan imagery into that specific environment, it blurs the line between private hate and public enforcement. The Klan itself is historically tied to the fusion of racial terror and local power.
Wow. Yeah, that really puts it in perspective. The author makes a sobering point about this current crisis, though. He argues that this dynamic isn't new at all. The department has been warned about the dangers of command silence allowing systemic bias to persist, and they've been warned across entirely different eras.
Yeah, the failure of supervisory intervention is, unfortunately, a recurring theme in the department's history. The author points back to the 113th Precinct in Queens, specifically in 1988, as a prime example of how the institution handles or mishandles these structural warnings.
Right, and the New York Times reported heavily on the 113th Precinct back then. It was a command where Black officers faced extreme operational racial hostility, and the author of our source material was actually a delegate with the Guardians Association at the time.
Which gives him a really unique perspective.
Exactly. And he notes that the hostility went way beyond locker room slurs. In one instance, a Black mannequin was dragged behind a patrol car through the public streets.
Unbelievable.
I mean, what does the day-to-day actually look like in a precinct operating under that level of racial disharmony?
Well, it looks like a complete breakdown of internal protocol. It means assignments are distributed based on in-groups and out-groups. It means critical information isn't shared at roll call. The department itself actually conceded there was severe racial disharmony in the 113th precinct.
Okay, so they admitted it.
They did. But their administrative solution in 1988 is what the author focuses on. They simply transferred 49 officers out of the command.
49 officers. I mean, that was nearly a quarter of the entire precinct. But they didn't identify specific wrongdoers, and they filed no formal charges against anyone for the environment that was created.
Right. The institution opted for disruption over accountability.
So what does this all mean? They just dispersed those 49 officers to other precincts across the city. It's like taking a contaminated water supply and pouring a little bit into every other well in town, hoping it just dilutes. Or like moving mold from the basement to the attic and claiming you cleaned the house.
Yes, and that dilution strategy is exactly what makes it so dangerous. Disruption without accountability simply teaches the institution a terrible lesson.
Because no one really gets in trouble.
Exactly. It signals to the rank and file that major command poisoning misconduct is entirely survivable as long as responsibility remains diffuse enough. No one lost their pension. No one was criminally charged for the hostile environment. The problem's just relocated.
And we saw the exact same structural collapse documented a few years later, right? In the 1990s by the Mullen Commission. They didn't just look at isolated acts of corruption. They were tasked with diagnosing a systemic failure.
They were. The Mullen Commission dedicated significant time to analyzing the code of silence. They explicitly called out willfully blind supervisors and a culture that prized blind loyalty over integrity.
Which sounds exactly like the group chat situation.
Precisely. The commission noted that honest officers feared being labeled a rat more than they feared the consequences of breaking the law. If you look at the timeline the author lays out, the Mullen Commission warned the department decades ago that when supervisors are passive, the department actively manufactures the conditions for misconduct to become durable.
So this is history repeating itself.
Sadly, yes. The supervisory inaction we're allegedly seeing in the current Manhattan North group chat mirrors the exact failures the Mullen Commission dissected.
Which brings us to the immediate victims of this toxic command culture. Because before we even talk about the public, the people most immediately endangered are the officers themselves, the people inside the building.
Yes. The author notes a crucial detail regarding the current Manhattan North narcotics case. Employees who have knowledge of these digital images, or who possess the screenshots, are terrified to hand them over to internal affairs.
Wow.
Yeah, they are actively withholding evidence because they fear retaliation from within their own unit.
And let's break down the logistics of that fear, because we aren't talking about hurt feelings over a bad joke. In a police department, your career is built on reputation, backup, and trust. If you report a group chat containing your boss and 17 colleagues, you get labeled a rat.
Right, you're an outcast.
You aren't considered a team player. You get frozen out of desirable assignments or overtime. But it goes far beyond career death. it becomes a matter of physical safety.
The vulnerability is absolute. If we look back at the 113th Precinct example from 1988 again, the author points out that Black female officers alleged their radio calls for backup were being intentionally ignored.
See, I can't even fathom the psychological toll of that. You are out on the street dealing with a dangerous situation, you key your mic for help, and you know the people receiving that call might just take their time getting to you.
It's terrifying.
You are working in a state of constant engineered vulnerability. How does a department function if you can't even trust the person in the patrol car next to you to have your back?
It doesn't.
Right?
And the author makes a vital distinction here. This fear of retaliation isn't just an unfortunate byproduct of a toxic culture. It is the actual enforcement mechanism of the bias.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The culture polices itself through intimidation. It creates an invisible, rigid hierarchy inside the precinct, dictating who belongs, who is believed, and who is safe.
So they don't even need to say anything explicitly.
Exactly. If every officer believes that telling the truth is more dangerous than staying quiet, the misconduct is heavily shielded from the inside out. The supervisors don't even need to actively threaten anyone. The culture does the heavy lifting for them.
So if the inside of the house is fundamentally broken, what happens to the core product of a narcotics unit?
Here's where it gets really interesting, because this is the point in the analysis where the consequences move from human resources to the justice system. The author details how internal bias inevitably causes evidentiary collapse.
We have to look closely at the mechanical nature of narcotics work for this. Unlike, say, a patrol officer responding to a 911 call after a crime has happened, narcotics enforcement relies incredibly heavily on proactive officer discretion and officer credibility.
Right, they're building the case from scratch.
Exactly. Often, a narcotics case comes down to a sworn narrative about a hand-to-hand drug transaction that no one else saw. There might not be video. The officer's word is the foundational evidentiary infrastructure of the entire prosecution.
So if a command is infected with bias, if officers are circulating exterminatory language and dehumanizing images, every single discretionary decision they make is compromised. Who they decide to put under surveillance, who they deem suspicious on a corner, who they choose to search, and who they ultimately arrest. Spot on. The legal system cannot conceptually separate the officer in the racist group chat from the officer on the witness stand. The author connects the historical failures we've discussed to the specific modern danger of organized racial misconduct today.
Because it taints everything they touch.
Right. If a narcotics unit's internal environment is poisoned by Klan imagery, how can a prosecutor, a judge, or a jury trust their sworn affidavits? The author brings up the legal concepts of Brady and Giglio rules to explain how this dismantles cases.
Okay, let's translate that for those who aren't lawyers. How do Brady and Giglio rules practically destroy a narcotics case?
So essentially, under Brady and Giglio obligations, the government is required to disclose to the defense any information that could impeach the credibility of their witnesses, and that includes police officers. An officer's documented history of racial bias is top-tier impeachment material. Imagine a defense attorney finding out the arresting officer was in this Manhattan North chat. They don't necessarily have to prove their client is innocent of a drug charge anymore. They just have to show the jury the Klan photo or the AI monkey image and ask, can you trust a single word written on this police report?
Right. The jury would just tune out.
Exactly. Yeah. The district attorney knows they cannot win that argument.
So the DA is forced to just drop the charges. A racist group chat doesn't just look bad for public relations. It legally obliterates the reliability of the unit's investigations. It forces mass case collapses.
It does. And the author uses the Joseph Franco scandal as a devastating case study of how this compounding interest of compromised credibility works. Joseph Franco was an undercover Bronx narcotics detective who fabricated evidence. He lied about witnessing drug transactions.
And the fallout wasn't just one ruined case, right? Because his credibility was completely destroyed, prosecutors across the city had to work backward and drop over 500 criminal cases he was involved in. 500 convictions or pending cases just wiped out. And it cost the city $1.7 million in civil settlements.
The Franco case really illustrates how false police narratives in narcotics work contaminate prosecutions on a massive industrial scale.
Mm.
Franco's issue was fabricated testimony, but the author argues the exact same structural logic applies to the current allegations of a biased command climate.
Because it's all about trust.
Exactly. The entire justice system relies on trust. When that trust is broken by organized racial misconduct, the system has to unwind years of police work.
And dropped cases and civil settlements are, well, that's the bureaucratic fallout. But the author pushes the analysis to the ultimate consequence. What happens when this broken culture hits the street?
The analysis traces a very clear historical progression from internal misconduct to public harm. Consider the Dirty 30 scandal from the early 1990s in Harlem.
Oh, wow, yeah.
This was a precinct where supervisors led a crew of officers in a massive criminal conspiracy. They used bogus radio runs to hide illegal searches from dispatch. They essentially turned the precinct's evidence control procedures into a drug dealing operation.
So the misconduct matured into organized criminality. The precinct's own infrastructure was hijacked to run a criminal enterprise.
The internal guardrails were completely gone. And then the author points to the horrific case of Abner Louima in 1997 to explain the darkest end of the spectrum.
And that case remains incredibly difficult to discuss. Abner Louima was a Haitian immigrant who wasn't just beaten on the street during an arrest. He was taken into the 70th Precinct Station House and brutally tortured with a broken broomstick inside the precinct bathroom.
It's horrific. Mm-hmm. And the author uses the Louima case to map out a vital institutional sequence. The public often views a brutal event like that as the violent start of a problem. But the author argues that by the time public violence of that magnitude happens inside a station house under the roof of the command, internal dehumanization and supervisory silence have already been eroding ethical boundaries for a very long time.
It's a buildup.
Yes. Dehumanization has to become culturally livable within the institution before it surfaces as torture under official control.
So the violence is the final symptom of a disease that has already conquered the host. And this erosion also takes the form of unconstitutional policing on a massive citywide scale. The text brings up the Floyd, Ligon, and Davis stop and frisk cases.
Wait, those are huge.
Yeah, these were major class action lawsuits where the courts actually proved that the NYPD was using race unlawfully in its discretionary enforcement, disproportionately targeting Black and Hispanic New Yorkers.
The courts proved the undeniable link between race and discretionary policing. But the author's focus is on how the department handled the aftermath, specifically detailing the findings in the Yates report. The Yates report analyzed the department's disciplinary system after judicial intervention and monitorship were put in place.
And the findings are honestly a masterclass in bureaucratic self-preservation. The Yates report showed that the department's disciplinary system routinely downgraded severe constitutional violations to mere training issues, or they excused unlawful stops as good faith mistakes. Why does the bureaucracy choose that route instead of firing bad actors?
Well, because formally admitting to a pattern of constitutional violations opens the city up to endless liability. It is risk management prioritizing itself over justice. By downgrading a constitutional violation to a training issue, the disciplinary system essentially teaches the officers that constitutional harm is manageable.
It's just a slap on a wrist.
Right. It signals that violating a citizen's rights is an administrative headache, not a career-ending crime.
So if we zoom out and trace the complete progression the author lays out, the causal chain is chillingly logical. It starts with internal bias, like a Ku Klux Klan image in a group chat. Supervisory silence allows that bias to normalize, telling the unit it's acceptable. That silence breeds organized misconduct, because the officers learn there are no internal consequences. Organized misconduct destroys the credibility of the officers, which destroys the reliability of criminal evidence. And destroyed evidence results in unconstitutional policing, mass wrongful prosecutions, and ultimately severe public violence.
The core takeaway from Eric Sanders' analysis is that a police department cannot maintain a conceptual wall between its internal workplace culture and its external policing practices. What happens inside the command invariably dictates how power is applied on the street.
It is a straight line from the break room to the courtroom. We've covered an immense amount of ground today on this deep dive into the source material. We started by looking at how a group chat containing exterminatory imagery isn't just a tasteless human resources problem. Through the historical lens of the 113th Precinct, the Mullen Commission, the Franco case, and the Yates Report, we've traced how command silence acts as an institutional catalyst.
We've seen how ignoring the termites inevitably compromises the entire structure.
Exactly. So as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder that builds on everything we've discussed. We've talked extensively today about the highly visible fallout of biased command climates, the false arrests, the collapsed court cases, the millions in civil settlements, the horrific acts of violence that make the evening news. But consider the invisible interactions for a moment. Think about the countless daily encounters between citizens and police that don't result in an arrest or a use of force or a piece of official paperwork.
The everyday interactions.
Right. If an officer's baseline perception of the public is being shaped by a dehumanizing command culture, a culture where exterminatory language is casually circulated and ignored by bosses, how does that alter the tone of a simple traffic stop? How does it change the tension during a routine request for directions or a wellness check at a private home? What is the unseen psychological toll on a community that has to constantly absorb the friction and suspicion of a biased institution, even when the law isn't formally invoked?
It is the slow, quiet erosion of civic trust. And once a community withdraws its trust, true public safety is almost impossible for an institution to maintain.
It's a heavy question, but an essential one to ask if we want to understand the true cost of institutional failure. We want to thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material today. Keep questioning the structures around you and keep looking for the mechanisms behind the headlines. And remember that hypothetical high-stakes environment we talked about at the very beginning, the one where your life depends on the people standing next to you. When the load-bearing walls of that trust are compromised, the whole house is at risk. Thanks for listening.